And our speaker this morning, kicking off, is David. Now, amongst his other talents, David is also a published poet, and he has copies of his poetry book here, if you would like to purchase those. And those are...
You have to speak to my agent.
What's the price of these?
£10.
£10 for one of those, and I'm sure David will do you the honour of signing that if you would like to have a copy of that. So, So amongst the other things that David has done, aside from writing philosophy, is he's been an advocate in employment tribunals, and before that a personal director for the UK operations of an international company. Now, to me, one of the wonderful things about belonging to Philsoc is we get people coming from all different sort of areas, and I think that's quite important when we're approaching a subject such as health. So David's talk today is Healthy Society, Mental Health and Habit. So over to you, David. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First question is, can you hear me? Clearly. There are handouts, you may have picked one up. I wasn't sure whether to give them out before or after, because some people like to make paper aeroplanes, so there they are. Welcome back to the theme of sanity. I want to spend the time talking about social sanity, and I want to do it in a controversial way. And then my learned friends, you can come back at me with all the arguments in the alternative. It was Hume's idea that we predict that something will occur in the future only if we have experience of it happening in the past. He famously said in his treatise of human nature, "To consider the matter aright, reason is nothing but a wonderful and unintelligible instinct in our souls, which carries us along a certain train of ideas. This instinct is, 'tis true, arises from past observation and experience. Nature may certainly produce whatever can arise from habit. Nay, habit is nothing but one of the principles of nature and derives all its force from that origin." And if there's anybody from the 18th century, I'm sorry, my accent wasn't perfect. I would argue that the survival of human beings, just like with any other species of animals, lies in the recognition that we operate our lives essentially through habit, and that the survival of the species will depend on the quality and nature of those habits. Above all, we need to question what drives those habits. This will lead us to the determination that more often than not, it is the factor of alienation that shapes them. We may feel we have no control over our lives, however talented we might be. We are basically working to someone else's schedule. The idea that around the corner there would be an amazing new discovery that would transform our lives has been a myth for a long time. We tend to take new discoveries to pull up our old bad habits. For example, the digital revolution has turned unfounded gossip into the venomous culture of post-truth. More frightening still, the iPad has made possible the extension of working hours into the home, so there's no more closing the office door or the factory gate. My reason for focusing on habit is to search for a route to social sanity. I do not doubt that humans have the capacity to lift their thinking to the highest order of reasoning and creativity. And as my friend Fromm said, mental health is the humanistic sense. In the humanistic sense, is characterized by the ability to love and to create, by the emergence from incestuous ties to clan and soil, by the sense of identity based on one's experience of self, by the development of objectivity and reason. Nevertheless, social habit still pervades and shapes our existence. the I and the we are connected for better or worse. To understand how we can live harmoniously, we need to consider what is going on in the everyday world. I'm going to lean heavily on the thinking of Erich Fromm in his books, Fear of Freedom and the Same Society. Not because I agree with everything he wrote, but because he identified the important issues testing our modern existence. I will lean toward the working world because it's where I spent 40 years of my life dealing with people problems of all shapes and sizes. So let's begin with Hume's custom or habit. We predict that something will occur in the future if we have experience of happening regularly in the past. We are determined by custom alone to expect one from the appearance of another. We draw from 1,000 instances an inference which we have not able to draw from one instance. That is in no respect different from them. Reason is incapable of any such variation. So Hume was concerned to confine our knowledge to that what we sense. And in his famous bread eating example, the only way we perceive nutrition is by the frequent repetition of the habit of eating. And we link the smell and taste of bread to the concept of nourishment, the truth of which he confines to nature's secret. At its crudest level, this idea of the cogency of habit has little to do with reason. If we're going to make sense of anything, we will logically make comparisons of any new phenomenon with what we can recall. Of course, Hume will leave us locked into the past as the only method of reasoning. His hypothesis was that all our reasonings concerning causes and effects are derived from nothing but custom. Kant disagreed with him. Whilst he accepted all cognition begins with experience, how should the cognitive faculty be awakened into exercise? He also argued that we are in possession of an a priori cognitive capability that enables to reason. Fromm distinguished intelligence from reason. Intelligence belongs to our animal part. And that doesn't matter how complex it becomes, it's still intelligence, he saw, still as very an animal response to the environment. It enables us to manipulate the world as it hits us. Reason is man's faculty for grasping the world of thought. So why don't we always reason our way through life and strip away old habits rather than hang on to what we know? So he posited the fear of the unknown. In his book, The Fear of Freedom, Fromm comments on the development of the Protestant ethic, borrowed from Max Weber, of course, which he claimed freed man spiritually and removing him from a fixed social system. This ought to have allowed the individual to succeed in personal economic gains as far as his diligence, intelligence, courage, thrift, or luck would lead him. Freedom is also, however, uncertainty, which undermines the complex structure of habit, customs, which make up our cultures. The individual seeks to escape from his uncertainty, and as Fromm put it, all passion. All passions and strivings. The individual ceases to be himself. He adopts entirely the kind of personality offered to him by cultural patterns. And he therefore becomes exactly as all others are and as they expect him to be. The discrepancy between I and the we disappears, and with it the fear of aloneness and powerlessness. The Fear of Freedom was first published in 1942, and it was Fromm's explanation of why blue-collar workers in Germany were attracted to Nazis. One could see the same process today with the rise of far-right populism and also extreme Islamism. His Sane Society was published in 1956 and is addressing the negative effect of capitalism as it was then emerging in the USA. Fromm saw the problem that humans became cogs in the economic machine. Specialization and the division of labor reduces work into a narrow, semi-skilled process under the control of someone else. For the individual, this produced a condition of alienation. In this respect, Fromm was in keeping with the thinking of Marx. In fact, in 1961, Fromm wrote a book, Marx's Concept of Man, in which he quotes Marx. Which he goes to Mark, man has been a hunter, a fisherman, a shepherd, or a critic, but must remain so if he does not want to lose his livelihood. Whilst in a common society, no one has one exclusive sphere of activity, but each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes. Fromm makes the point that Marx would have been critical of a Soviet factory just as much as a factory in the USA. But Fromm was less concerned with the ideology, much more concerned with the process of individuation, which left the person in complete aloneness and doubt. The clan or the religious community, he would argue, restricts freedom of the individual, but satisfies his need to belong. Freedom from means isolation, and that's what we seek to avoid. So habit and custom are like anchors in the past, providing a familiarity that might keep us sane. So we seem to be struggling between two types of sense identity. As Fromm put it, on the one hand you have individuality, and on the other, versus that, herd conformity. He sees man torn away from nature, struggling towards a sense of individuality with imagination and reason, and at the same time seeking a sense of identity gained by belonging to a group. But what about freedom towards something? Surely we have a need to be creative in order to express our individuality. Sorry. Fromm takes the view in the same society that all humans are striving beyond their physiological needs for an inner harmony. All passions and strivings are attempts to find an answer to this existence, or as we may also say, they are an attempt to avoid insanity. All men are idealists and cannot help being idealists, providing we mean by idealism the striving for the satisfaction of needs which are specifically human. The animal in us seeks union with the world by either submission to a person, institution or religion, or the opposite, by dominating other people through a part of a group by exercising power over it. And I can remember lots and lots of people in my career who wanted to dominate. In the alternative, Fromm argues there is a way of making connection with other people through what he calls productive love. And he defines this by a syndrome of attitudes, out of care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. So social sanity may be achieved through developing productive feelings rather than cravings to control or submit. So the next question should be, what in practical terms controls our relationships? The most important answer, in my view, is the economic structure in which we operate. Writing in the 1950s, Fromm argues that it is a fundamental feature of capitalism that working relationships are subject to a process of what he called quantification and abstractification. We become just figures on a page. The modern economy is a huge machine within which we have no control over our lives, and this produces alienation, which in turn produces mental health problems. Fromm contrasts the hand worker who completed the construction of a whole table with the industrial worker who only produces a piece of an article repetitively and has no control over his work. The worker, he said, becomes an economic atom that dances the tune of atomistic management. Fromm argues, in the 19th century the problem was that God is dead. In the 20th century the problem is that man is dead. The danger of the past was that men became slaves. The danger of the future is that men become robots. They will destroy their world and themselves because they cannot stand any longer the boredom of a meaningless life. Is cure? Humanistic communitarianism. And the key element in this was full participation in management and decision making. There is no doubt in my mind that modern manufacturing requires specialization and the division of labor. But this does not automatically mean that anyone working in a complex system suffers alienation. In my experience, there was usually a strong team culture among semi-skilled machine operatives, for example, which provided individuals with a type of community support. Moreover, systems of employee participation can involve individuals in the management of business, either because they've become representatives or simply because they're consulted on and share in important business decisions. I had the privilege of being involved in a major experiment in a manufacturing company in the 1980s. We called it joint planning. Employees elected representatives to the joint planning team of each factory, and we had 7 or 8 factories. They would sit together with management to discuss local issues before decisions were made. This empowered people to feel that they were part of a business entity which they could influence. We had to train the elected representatives in business principles and communication skills, and this was also empowering to the individuals involved, and as one of the trainers it was empowering to me as well. Alienation is a hazard of large economic organisations, but it's not unavoidable. It must be built into the culture of the workforce that it becomes a habit to think about business and address issues of success and failure. Employees feel in control of their lives, and this leads to higher motivation, which in turn may lead to lower sickness absence rates. This kind of philosophy is built into systems in France and Germany. I know quite a lot about the Triage in Germany, similar sort of thing in France, where employee rights for making decision is contained. Fromm recognised that quantification and abstractification were both an inevitable feature of modern industry, as we said. The individual skilled tradesman constructed a table will be replaced by a genius called workers who were producing output to requires quantity and quality. Whilst he thought this was the platform for alienation, he was, like me, of the view it need not necessarily be the case. However, my constructive experience of the working world in the late 20th century seems to be vanishing in the 21st century with the so-called gig economy and zero-hour contracts. If we move from the 1950s to the present day, we are seeing an extension of the alienation problem together with the diminution of employment rights. The social philosopher Hartmut Rosa highlights the problem in his essay Alienation and Acceleration. In his essay, he explains that ever since the 18th century, technology has theoretically enabled man to produce things at a faster and perhaps more efficient rate. This should have liberated us to give us more free time to develop our individuation. In fact, it's had the opposite effect. Living has accelerated and we have less control. Rosa puts forward what he calls a circle of acceleration. There is technical acceleration, which in turn accelerates social change, which in turn accelerates the pace of life. The acceleration that's occurring in the present generation is that caused by digitalization. The iPhone, for example, puts paid to the distinction between normal hours of work and free time. 24-hour access is not uncommon, and at all levels of industrial organization and commercial organization, I should say. So technically, we would have the possibility of creating more free time, but as Rosa puts it, the individual in the late modern society does not enjoy the luxury of more leisure. He says, living to the fullest has become the core objective of our time. And at the same time, this hunger for new things is never satisfied. No matter how fast we become, the proportion of the experiences we will continuously shrink. We have will continuously shrink in the face of those we missed. As a result, more and more people suffer from depression and burnout. The social acceleration he describes that dominates our lives has two engines. The first is an economic one, which might be depicted with the famous Benjamin Franklin expression, time is money. The faster we operate, the more we make. The second engine is a social cultural one. The overriding value in today's world is to live for today and be glued to our screens in order to maximize the experiences of today. The economic engine reflects factors outside our control, but its social acceleration is more a question of habit. We work hard, play hard. In Fromm's view, even the consumption is just a way of suppressing the individual's awareness of real happiness, which all just fuels alienation. So we're back against the problem of habit, but not custom. We will ignore the past if the digital world is controlling our shaping our habits. If control of this world lies with a small group of organizations, then the same society lies outside of individuals' control or influence. We will, as Fromm predicted, become robots, but now with earpieces and iPads, which he couldn't have envisaged. For reason to have an effect, it requires an independence of thought and an evaluation of facts. If false facts are fed to us, truth is hard to ascertain, then we will become creatures of bad habits, and those habits shaped by others. This surely is a recipe for social insanity. The recent tendency in this country has been to water down, in my view, employment rights protection. Linked to the above, we need to address poverty so the imbalance of wealth in our society is moderated and poor people are not quietly enslaved by the system. Employees need to be given a stronger voice in organisations so they do not feel alienated and have a contribution to make the business decisions. Socially, we have a bigger problem. We have long ago moved away from steady, custom-determined society, and this has been replaced by an intensive, acquisitive society. Unbridled capitalism seemed to follow in the wake of the collapse of communism, and we saw the damage this had on international banking. Many people live on credit either because they have no choice or because they want to fill the present with constant consumption. We need a refreshment of social habits to create a more caring society, or as Fromm put it at the end of his book, man can protect himself from the consequences of his own madness only by creating a sane society which conforms with the needs of man, needs which are rooted in the very conditions of his existence. A society which man relates to, which man relates to man lovingly, in which he is rooted in the bonds of brotherliness and solidarity rather than ties of blood and soil. I'm sorry, I keep using the word man, but that's how he quoted it. So Fromm envisaged the task to be that we develop solidarity with our fellow creatures and caring for them, which was his definition of love, pushing aside the Freudian version, and B, to promote happiness, which he defined as fullness, the opposite of depression, which he considered was emptiness. Mental health, in the humanistic sense, is the ability to love and to create a fully born, fully awake. On the other hand, the alienated man suffers from a lack of self. I am anxious, dependent on the approval of others, constantly trying to please. So if the social syndrome of acceleration described by Rosa is generating a sense of alienation, this means the individual is in the clutch of a society which demands he works harder and faster and limits the interaction with other individuals to an electronic contact devoid of personal control. The new social habits are high speed and electronically delivered, and this could lead away from social and individual mental health. The answer, therefore, is to slow the pace of life, to allow people time to connect in a full human sense. With this, we also require measures to ensure that nobody needs to work around the clock in order to earn a living wage. It's time to shift from a fixation on ever-increasing quantity towards a focus on the quality of life for all of us. Then we should achieve social sanity and with it promote individual mental health. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David. So in the usual way, we'll do questions. So if you've got a question, please put up your hand and David will hopefully answer them. So we have one straight away from Alan. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's a fascinating approach and I agree with a lot of what you said. The question I have is whether the from picture of people being subordinated to the machine in their work experience is up to date. We are now installing robots. Manufacturing is only 10% of total employment anyway, I think it's true to say, something of that order. And a lot of jobs are more discretionary. Indeed, it can be contrasted with what you also mentioned, the gig economy, where people are doing jobs but not sure when and how they will be working next. It doesn't give them much freedom, but it's certainly not a production line. And I suspect that the sort of modern times Charlie Chaplin image of people just screwing nuts down is being replaced by robots. And there's the opposite problem, that people only get temporary gig-type jobs, and as you said, all of poverty and inequality ensues from that. But that's economics in psychological terms. I would have thought that total automation of working life is rather old hat.
Well, it may appear like that in the UK, but we mustn't forget that the reason why manufacturing has disappeared practically overnight, I agree, in this country, apart from some very specialist areas, is that because it is being all produced in China or similar countries at a lower rate. So they're going through now perhaps when we went through in the 19th century. So that's one thing. I think there's a difference, yes, where you're on a machine producing things as opposed to sitting at home with your iPhone. In fact, I'd say it's more dangerous now because I used to work very much with semi-skilled people and they start to love their products. I've seen people, I was in the brown box field, and I've seen people spend hours and hours to get the perfect production of this brown box. But the most important thing, there was a social aspect to working, and now that's disappearing, and I think that can be worse than any alienation we had in the past.
Frank?
From heads a lovely idealistic.
Can you talk a bit up? Can you stand up, Frank, and talk a bit louder? Thank you.
From paints a nice idealistic picture of let's slow down, let's have more love. And gorgeous, but he doesn't seem to give any clues of how we get there, how we switch from this awful situation that begins to be now, obviously, you have it, to that state. Does he give us any practical clues as to how the switch might take place?
I agree with you. It is a huge task. And you do have to change people's motivations. As far as he's concerned, we must be fair to him. He is writing in the 50s at a time when he saw production lines becoming very, very automated. And at a time, I suppose, when everybody said, oh, it's wonderful, capitalism is wonderful, it's working beautifully. So I think it's something which we have to address through communities, almost separate from work, and in all aspects of our education and our own relationships. He doesn't have an automatic answer to these things. He's just saying, please, please, start looking at it now.
Stuart?
Sorry, can I just...
Yeah.
That is fine, as a sort of exhortation to the common man. But that's all very well, but I mean, the common man and woman is stuck in this economic situation we're in. There has to be a lead from somewhere.
Yes.
From government or from some... incredible individual who is able to start a movement that can lead public opinion and so on.
I'm 100%.
How is it going to happen?
I agree with you 100%. We need a political development now, which doesn't exist in any of the parties I can see, to move things forward. We need some fundamental changes, and otherwise, I think there will be social deterioration. I agree with you. It's something that's missing.
Stuart?
Yes, at the very beginning of your talk, when you mentioned the Theatre of Freedom, first published in 1942, about Fromm's explanation of why the blue collar workers were attracted to the Nazis. Yes, we can understand that because it was a reaction to the Great Depression of the 30s, and they saw hope in what Nazism showed and how it presented themselves. I think some of us can see this approach in America resulted in the election of Trump. However, I do feel it's rather dangerous for you to then take this further, to class extreme Islamism in the same breath. To me, it seems that you're oversimplifying an extremely complex problem, and you shouldn't be bringing that into the Theatre of Freedom and to Fromm. And I'd like to understand why.
Okay. What he does in the Theatre of Freedom, he spends a long time talking about the change from a very stereotyped, ordered society, Catholic society, into the Protestant, where ideally you're meant to be free and able to build your own career, but that freedom then created uncertainty. I agree with you, and I am a bit critical of that area of his work, because I think that's simplistic. And when I went back and read Max Weber's Protestant Ethic afterwards, or reread it, and I feel he was not, he didn't have his finger quite on the button. My own position is that we tend to live our lives not just with reason but with beliefs, whether we're religious believers or just we have a framework of belief in the way we live our lives. And what is clear that when there's a degree of uncertainty, you no longer can trust things anymore. And that might be caused by a war, an extreme case, or inflation, or just losing your job. You turn to somebody who might be able to, who says to you, don't worry, just listen to me, I will make it all right. That's what Trump said. He said, let's go and dig coal. And that's no different from what Hitler was saying in those days, except he was rather... racist. Well, isn't Trump racist? I forget. So yes, it is the uncertainty, the need to belong, is a powerful force in humans, and that powerful force can take you to Syria to become an Islamist, or it can take you and make you want to support some extreme right-wing organisations.
Bob.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you said. To judge from what I see people saying on television, one huge source of alienation which makes people unhappy is not so much their own economic situation as the feeling that the country they live in is nothing like what it was when they were growing up. And people have this desperate need to feel that England is England. And so Nigel Farage takes advantage of this. And thinks we can sort of turn the clock back to the 1950s and everything was wonderful. Everybody was white and we had capital punishment. You know, those wonderful things. Nobody ever told a lie. And that's you can't get rid of that. I mean, unless you just stop all progress. And another thing that alienates people, I think, is in the good old days, if you were a man, you did a job which lasted 40 hours a week. You did the same job your whole life, and you had a sense of worth as someone who was providing for a family, etc. Even if you hated what you did, so at least you had that sense of pride. Now, for a lot of people, I'm not talking about myself, I'm above all this, of course. But I read in the papers that sense of worth has tended to be undermined by new sort of work product. The fact that the fact that women do so much work, and therefore men do less, to some extent, and don't feel like the breadwinner. This has a huge effect, but it's not because of anything bad. It's just because of the way things have developed over the last few years, and that sort of alienation, very very difficult, seems to me to sort out. Not by any
To pick up your first point, yes, of course. This idea of leaning on the past is a manifestation of habit, social habit. The things that we're familiar with, when we knew everybody, when things were so predictable. And underlying that, Saucy mentioned that the risk element of work in those days didn't exist. When I left school, I could get a dead-end job, and I could probably have lived in that dead-end job for the rest of my life. Well, not now anymore. So there is that dimension. It is the habit we crave, and we've got to push it away and look for more creative things. We've got to use our reason. We've got to lift ourselves into a more creative society.
John.
I really wish I knew what I wanted to ask you. My mind is full of too much. But I'd like to start off by saying thanks for what you said, and that on some points you and I stand together. But on other points I think we're separated by the distance to the moon. Now I think you've asked me and the audience to subscribe to the general idea that things are getting worse and that mental health is a major problem. Now, I'd like to try and challenge you, not directly, but in an intellectual sense, on your basis first for saying intellectual health has got worse. But that's only the start, because I'm going to suggest that our measurement of mental health has improved so much from the 1930s to 2017. And it may be what we're seeing is an improvement in measurement rather than a worsening in the amount of mental health. But more importantly, the point I want to make is that against the background of having spent a whole morning walking around the factory that makes minis in Oxford, I've never seen and witnessed more robots, but more happy, contented, well-dressed workers. And it's against that background that I say, let's just assume that mental health is getting worse. And I'm prepared to subscribe to that, but I still think it may be a matter of definition and measurement rather than actual fact. But let's assume it is. But let's look at the same time at the things are getting better. Everybody's living a lot longer. Never before in previous generations has there been a group of people like this able to get into their, I hate to use the word motor car, or their buses or their trains, and attend a seminar or a lecture like this. My father would have been sitting in the corner of a council house reading the Daily Worker or something like that at his age. Fewer and fewer people are suffering from hunger. And I would argue that whilst we've got a terrible housing problem in Oxford and in the UK, never has the actual revision of housing versus the number of people in the country being better than it is now. And never before have the population had access to things like music and education the way they have today. The music comes from the iPhone, the YouTube and the internet. Education comes from the government and the internet. And I think so many things have got better. We've never been less hungry, and we've never had less pain, and we've never lived so long.
Well, there are a number, as you said, there are a number of issues that you raised there. One of them is that right at the beginning you said, of course, things may look statistically as if they're getting worse, but it's just because we're reporting them or examining them or finding them out better. But one is also conscious that almost every week when you listen to the news, there is another organisation apologising for its failure, whether that's NHS, whether that's the police, social care, or whether it's Grenfell Towers. I mean, the Grenfell Tower problem is not new. They've been producing appalling buildings to bad regulations for years, for decades, and nobody cares. So I don't feel that this country, this society, is something I can get very excited about at the moment. I think there's a lot going, there's a lot wrong in it, and we do need to think about people more. And yes, of course, you don't have a working class with all the men wearing black caps parading through the streets anymore to fight against poverty, but you do have people quietly going to food banks, a lot of them going to food banks, people, educated people, who can't afford to live without that. So I don't see this society which is good. But that's just my view.
Now, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for now, and I'm sorry to those people who had their hands up and wanted to ask questions. There will be panel time after the coffee break, so it'll give you an opportunity to ask those questions then. So can I ask you now to all...